The 2017 legislative session in Kansas is still going, which makes it one of the longest legislative sessions in the entire history of the state. The sticking point? Legislators have been working for months on a new funding formula for Kansas schools. The formula that had determined district budgets for almost a quarter century was scrapped in 2015. And questions about adequate funding for education have gone all the way to the Kansas Supreme Court. A new formula was sent to Governor Brownback's desk on Monday night. Alan Roop, who represents districts suing the state, says he likes the formula, but he also says there's zero chance the high court will be satisfied unless lawmakers put more money into it.
It's like building a great car engine and putting in a thimble full of gas.
That thimble is smallest in rural districts where dwindling enrollment brings the threat of school closure or consolidation. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show on KCUR's Central Standard is all about the challenges facing rural schools in Kansas and Missouri. Let's start by getting an overview of the issues from KCUR's Celia Yopis Jepson. She just joined our team as part of the Kansas News Service, and she comes to us from the Topeka Capital Journal, where she did a five-part series on school consolidation along the Kansas-Nebraska border. Hi, Celia. I'm so glad you're here.
Hi. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks so much.
Celia, the big news, of course, is that last night the Kansas legislature voted to override Sam Brownback's veto on a tax increase, which effectively ends the big Kansas tax experiment. Could that be a game changer for public education in the state? Does that solve the problem of the thimble full of gas?
Well, I mean, there's a big debate, first of all, over whether there's a thimble of gas or not, because, of course, there's been a lot of arguing about how much money schools need. We'll also see when the Kansas Supreme Court has a look at the school finance legislation, whether they consider it adequate or not. So I think that we'll see moving forward what people think about that amount of money that's going in.
A lot of our listeners probably hear the news about school funding woes through an urban or suburban lens. What are some of the particular concerns for rural schools?
Oh, gosh. There are a lot of challenges that rural schools face. One is just geography. With geography comes challenges recruiting teachers, keeping teachers, transportation. I rode one bus in Syracuse. We drove 65 miles on largely unpaved country roads to pick up 8 kids. So
how long did that take?
It took an hour and a half. So you're looking at higher costs per kid. And also to try to get the same resources, you have to do some remote work in that same district in Syracuse. The closest community college was 2 counties away. So to be able to offer kind of like dual credit, you know, college level classes and such is a completely different experience in these rural areas.
So for most rural districts, people are concerned about what they consider a looming threat of consolidation, where several towns combine schools because the population loss in so many of those towns makes it hard to keep classrooms full. Can you explain why people in rural communities in Kansas, anyway, have such a fear of consolidation?
Oh, I think that really goes back to the history of consolidation. In the 1940s, 50s, and then above all in the 1960s, Kansas mandated consolidation. We used to have nearly 3,000 districts in this state because elementary and secondary were separate. And now we have 286 districts. Well, the forced consolidation completely changed the landscape. And it really affects, you know, when schools consolidate, school districts consolidate, it usually ends up in closure of certain schools. That means you don't have the same amount of jobs in those towns. Schools buying milk and meat and bread locally and gassing up their buses. And so it does change the landscape. There are areas of Kansas losing population still. And
so it changes the economy of an entire town to lose a school.
That's exactly it.
So, you know, you talked about the history in the 1960s. A more recent wave of consolidation kind of picked up pace in about 2000. Why is that?
That's a good question. It could be related to several factors. Based the state's aid for schools dropped after the recession and then following the tax cuts in 2012. At the same time, there were incentives since the early 2000s for schools to consolidate, financial incentives. So it's probably been a combination of factors, continued population loss as well in certain areas.
And Sam Brownback asked for a report on schools and school funding in 2012 also. And there were some recommendations having to do with realigning district boundaries, efficiency. Can you explain how that might play in?
Well, basically, consolidation is so taboo. I can't emphasize how taboo it is. So every few years in the legislature, they kind of dance around the topic by, you know, doing various reports that talk about, well, what would we save by maybe making districts consolidate administration or purchasing or things like that. But usually after these reports, it seems like there's not necessarily that much action that takes place.
And that's because of how taboo it is?
Well, no, I think it's a combination of things. Number one, I think that sometimes it seems that the logistics of consolidating certain things like purchases or things like that maybe aren't as easy or maybe don't save as much money, or there are concerns about the logistics of how to make that happen when you actually come down to talking about, okay, so how would we implement this? And then there is the issue that it's politically volatile because you do affect your local economy if you're not going to be kind of like purchasing locally or such.
Let's talk about the logistics a little more. I'd like you to flesh that out. Why is it logistically complicated to consolidate schools?
Well, that would depend on what level you're talking about. If you're talking about like full consolidation, right now in Kansas, that's up to school boards. And school boards are locally elected, so you need two school boards to decide, you know, together that they want to consolidate. And then they have to figure out what's going to happen next. It's not always as easy as, okay, we have a district here and a district here, let's, you know, become one. Well, you have to figure out, so where are your kids going to go to school next? And which teachers are going to have jobs and which don't? I talked to a district in along the Nebraska border that went through that process, and it took a long time. Sometimes you ironically have to build a new building that can fit all the kids, say all the high schoolers, because neither high school of the two districts is big enough. So sometimes there are actually extra expenses to start. It's a little ironic.
And then the fear of consolidation being so intense that politicians can't really get away with saying they support it. What kinds of things do people say instead?
Oh, well, I mean, so there's just kind of a fear of saying the word consolidation. So I feel like sometimes you hear maybe, you know, people dancing around the word saying like boundary realignment or administrative realignment or, you know, well, we're not mandating schools to close if we realign the boundaries. Well, you know, yeah, the 1960s legislation, I've read it myself, also did not say you have to close schools, but consolidating usually ends up in closing the actual school buildings. That's just the reality of it. So, but no one likes to talk about it.
What are some of the, like, on-the-ground situations that are driving all of this? I mean, population loss is a big piece of it, but how does that fit into the big picture of just what you experience when you talk to people in these towns day to day?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it is population loss. If you look at where most of the consolidation has happened since around 2000, it's mostly the Nebraska border. I think that's where most of the districts have been. Most of the counties there have experienced consolidation since then. But you look at the population in those counties, Republic County, for example, has lost 40% of its population since 1970. I mean, this is significant population loss.
Yeah, that's almost half.
Right.
And so why? Why has that particular county lost so much population?
I wondered that, and I asked some professors why that corridor along the Nebraska border has lost so much. I mean, I've heard some speculation maybe it has to do with I-70, you know, drawing some, you know, maybe 30, how is it 36, I believe, Highway 36, mm-hmm. Perhaps had more business along that route before I-70. I'm not really sure, but I think it's an excellent question.
I mean, when we talk about population loss in rural communities, it gets discussed so often as though it's inevitable or maybe the better word is just irreversible, like that there's nothing that could turn this around and that we have to make decisions based on the assumption that this is happening and it's going to continue happening. But not everyone agrees with that. I mean, people talk about that maybe changes in housing stock could fix all of this. Are there solutions outside of education to some of these problems people are facing that end up affecting education?
Well, definitely economic development officials in rural areas feel that way. They feel like the media or the public in general view rural areas as kind of like on their way out and, hey, there's nothing you can do about it. But, you know, if you look at, for example, some areas of West Kansas that were losing population but now have mega dairies coming into their areas and such, their school districts are growing, their population is growing. So, you know, is something irreversible? No, it just depends on what's going on in that area.
The fear in so many rural communities is that closing schools kills a town. But could the opposite be true? Could you say that it's actually that a dying town is what ultimately kills a school?
I think that's the big chicken or egg argument. And it leads to a lot of hand-wringing and, you know, wondering how we got to this point when a school does close or a school district consolidates. But that, you know, I've not found a good answer to that. Where do things start and where do things end?
Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what the school in your rural community means to you and let us know how it's doing. 816-235-2888. We'll hear from teachers, parents, and administrators when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us for more on the future of rural education. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Celia Yopis-Jepson, a KCUR reporter for the Kansas News Service. We're talking about the particular challenges for education in rural communities right now. Hi again, Celia.
Hi.
We've got another guest in the studio who I want to talk to, but I'd like to first turn to one of our callers who's just given us a ring at 816-235-2888. Shannon in Kansas City, good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
What can you tell us about your hometown?
Well, my hometown is in McPherson County. It's called Marquette, population 600. And in 1985, it lost its high school in a unified school district with Lindsburg. But for 25 years or 30 years, it had middle school and elementary. And then maybe 5 or 8 years ago, they closed middle school. And then about 2 years ago, they closed the elementary school. So now there's not a community-based school and everybody is bused.
When you say everybody is bused, can you tell me a little more what that looks like just for families there?
Sure. Well, what's disappointing about this situation is there's another unified school district to the south with Little River Windham. And so what has happened, it's a bit divided the community because people who live kind of on one side of town send their kids to Little River Windham. And then people who live on another side send their kids to Lindsburg. And then there are a few others that go to McPherson or wherever. But there's buses that come to town from both districts. And the kids line up on Main Street, is my understanding, and they go their different directions.
So this already fairly small community gets split. And, you know, how does that affect not just kids' education, but, I mean, the community itself? Do you feel like people are not as tightly knit as a result of this? Or?
Well, you know, it's a tightly knit community anyway just because of the size. But, yeah, I mean, there's... Yeah, you know, you lose some of that community feeling just because your kids don't go to school together. Plus, you know, the school is always a rallying point for everybody to, and now there's not so much that, you know, right there in the community for people maybe who don't have kids to go to a football game or go to a musical event or whatever.
You know, thank you so much for that call, Shannon. I want to ask you about that, Celia, about the school as a rallying point for a community, because we haven't touched on what the schools mean to rural communities, like in terms of the heart, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. People kind of have described to me their local schools as the glue, and said, you know, if there's a school event going on, I guarantee you everyone in town is there. And that is the feeling in rural areas.
Well, let's hear now from Joe Kelly. He's just accepted a job that will take him to DeSoto, Kansas next year, but he's currently the assistant superintendent of Holton Schools. That's a small district north of Topeka where he also, I understand, drove the bus for a while.
Oh no, they couldn't trick me into that one. I was the transportation director, though.
Okay. Well, Joe, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about your background. You're actually from Kansas City originally, right?
I am. I'm a Johnson County native.
What drew you first to education?
I mean, I think it's what draws anybody into education. I just wanted to spend my life helping people, I think.
I mean, there are a lot of ways to do that.
There are. You know, I got an opportunity to work with migrant students down in Florida after college. Loved doing that. And then I decided to go get my certification at Rockhurst University down the street.
Working with migrant students in Florida after college, I mean, do you see, are there parallels from what you did in that context to working in this rural district in Kansas?
Oh, most definitely. And I think that's something that rural districts are facing all across the state is, you know, we have a meatpacking plant in Holton, and we're seeing kids who come to this country who walked basically here from Guatemala. And they don't even speak Spanish. They speak an oral dialect of Guatemalan, like Quiche or Chu. And so communicating with those kids and helping them learn the language, it's a challenge.
So, you know, you used to teach in Liberty, and that's essentially a Missouri suburb of Kansas. What took you to a more rural district in the first place?
Well, a couple of things. You know, they had an opportunity for a district level and building level administrative position, which I was looking for, and that really attracted me. The other thing is my wife is from a small town in western Kansas, and she said she was coming with me to the interview. And so we went to Holton and fell in love with it. And she said, this is the kind of small town that we can move to.
What do you mean, the kind of small town you can move to?
You know, coming from Johnson County, I hadn't had a lot of experiences with small towns. And, you know, there are small towns where there are things like industry. There's things like in Holton, we have a reservoir, state reservoir, and, you know, a hospital. But there are, unfortunately, communities where the hospital closed. There's not a lot of industry and there's not a lot going on. So, you know, Holton is the kind of place where I would move from a place like Liberty to.
So you're saying that maybe some of our generalizations about small towns, we should parse that out a little bit.
I would say that'd be a good idea. I actually had my friends convinced that I lived on a horse farm. I called it the Kelly Ranch. It's just a ranch style house, though. No horses.
Can you help us picture maybe just people who might have stereotypes about what is a small town? Help us picture the particularities of Holton. You mentioned a lot like immigrant students, mm-hmm. and I would say that might be a big part of it. You know, mm-hmm. the diversity that in my mind would represent mm-hmm. doesn't fit the stereotype.
And it really doesn't. You know, I talk with family and friends from this area, and, you know, it's a surprise to them. And it's also surprising to them to hear that there are progressive people in a small community. You know, one of the things that they think of is, well, how do you fit in there? You don't really like country music that much. And I have to explain to them, no, people don't really listen to that much country music all over. It's there, but, you know, they're surprised to hear that we have a new school building there because the community decided to invest in itself.
So that investment in the school building, how do you see that moving into the future? Do you see that as a safe investment, a good investment?
I do. I think that, you know, the community was a little bit divided for a while, but decided to come together. And, you know, we talked with the State Department, and when people put in new schools, there is a tendency for there to be population growth and attract new families. So in the long run, I think it will be a quality investment.
So how is that district doing, the Holton district? Is it suffering from some of the challenges that Celia described, or...
It does. This block grant that the legislature has given us, we've had to make some cuts because, you know, they say that they're not cutting money, but our expenses aren't going down. You know, we try to give people, a competitive salary and one that they can pay their insurance and they can pay their bills on. And so when our funding is frozen, but our expenses are increasing, that and utilities, but personnel is usually your largest expense in a school district, it's hard to maintain that level of service.
How big is the Holton district? How many students are in it?
About 1,000.
Per class, what does that look like?
We try to keep it at about 20, 22.
So what are some of the challenges that you see at maybe the classroom level?
Oh, at the classroom level, it's probably recruiting. I mean,
recruiting good teachers?
Yeah, well, and the number that we're seeing. It's hard to find personnel certified in all the areas that we need. We're lucky that we're about 30, 35 minutes north of Topeka, but I can't even imagine what it's like for, districts out from where my wife is from, out in Colby, what it's like for them. They're not really near a lot of higher institutions of learning. I mean, there's Fort Hays State. But how do you attract a new college kid to come out to a place where they're not from, they don't know anybody, and quite honestly, the salary and benefits aren't as competitive as where they are in the suburban or urban districts.
And you were saying that you were working in transportation in Holton, too?
Correct.
Tell me about that role.
Well, when you work in a small district, you fulfill multiple roles. I managed the budget there and oversaw transportation, in town and outside of town. But I tell people I also am the curriculum director. I'm also the assistant principal. After 2:30, I'm the janitor because the janitor's driving a bus. So, I mean, you just fill in those roles so that things get done.
This bus issue seems like one of the big ones, finding people to drive the bus.
Oh, yeah.
Why is that?
Well, you can't make a living driving a bus. Celia was talking about you have an hour and a half route in the morning and an hour and a half route in the afternoon. That doesn't really appeal to a lot of people for full-time employment. So you're relying heavily on your retired people. People who are from the community and who know the back roads. And so it's hard to bring in people from outside the district to fill those positions.
Is there just some other way of imagining how all of this could work that's crossed your mind? I mean, we have this way of thinking that's, okay, there needs to be either more students, more money, or some combination of the two. Otherwise, schools are inevitably going to consolidate, and then these long distances need to get traversed. When these long distances need to get traversed, it's hard to find a bus driver. Mm-hmm. Kids are having long commutes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Is there some other, if you were going to make just a totally other picture, is there one?
What I'd like to do is, at step one, I'd like for people to be able to talk about it. And I don't even think we're at a point where we can have a productive conversation about what the solutions are, because people are... It's so taboo to talk about any changes that you can't get people to move off center.
Can you describe that for me more? What happens when people try to talk about it?
Usually there's a lot of raised voices, and people will leave the room, if I'm honest. I mean, you hear about the 60s and consolidation. You talk to some of the old timers, and there's always a story about somebody having a heart attack in a town hall meeting.
What do people really talk about the 60s when this comes up? I mean, that there's that sort of lived memory of that history.
It's ingrained in our DNA now as Kansas schools.
I mean, you say that people talk about heart attacks, but I mean, what else do people talk about when they talk about the 60s? What kinds of stories do they tell that have set this in people's minds as like the most taboo subject there could be about schools?
You guys were talking earlier about, does the town die first or the schools? I think the schools, when you think of them closing, it's a visual. It's real. That's when you know that it's the end.
You can't deny that something's changing here.
Exactly. You can't pretend like things will get better when they're not really getting better. And so it's really emotional for people. And, the schools in these communities are the hearts, especially where you've had a major industry leave or you've had a hospital close. The schools are the thing that people cling to as, at least we have the schools still.
So you are leaving Holton after 4 years there. Why?
Mostly family. I would say family, that and there's a challenge, a new challenge for me to impact more kids. And the DeSoto School District is a jump up in terms of enrollment. But I call it Roy Williams syndrome. You know, Roy was the coach at KU and he ended up going back home to North Carolina. One thing that I've tried to do is try to get some people who are from the Houlton area or from that area to apply for the job and say, hey, this is a good position.
Don't just go back to where they're from?
That's exactly, yeah, pretty much.
When you talk about also serving more kids, is that a common desire for teachers? In urban areas, you'll hear a lot about teachers having so many students, they don't have time to be personal with them or mm-hmm. to, really address their needs fully, that mm-hmm. their time is divided. Mm-hmm. But is there a problem also for teachers who want to make a difference in having such a small school to work in?
I think that's a good question. You know, in a small school, I think as a teacher, you can do more things. You could teach more subjects or you can coach more areas and not be so specialized. But for me as an administrator, I think that is something that I find amongst quite a few administrators that you want to have a broader impact. But then again, there are administrators who are from these towns and their families from there, and they want to stay and make a difference in the community that they grew up in.
Well, Joe Kelly, hang on with us for just a moment. I want to turn back to Celia Yopis Jepson from KCUR to get a sense of, you know, what you hear in Joe's story that maybe we haven't fully teased out.
Well, one thing that struck me is, you know, this, you're talking about the 1960s again and consolidation. I actually think it's a big chapter in U.S. history that most of us do not know much about, because this wasn't just Kansas. By the end of the 60s, the U.S. lost half of its school districts. So this was a major debate nationally about, is it better for kids to be in bigger schools or in smaller schools? And there were people on both sides of the debate. And so I think that many of us who grew up after that just aren't aware of how that debate and this massive change in school structure changed our educational landscape.
What is the argument for it being bad for kids to be in small schools?
Fewer opportunities. That the argument for, you know, against the smaller schools back then, and really now it's the same thing, is that, well, kids have fewer opportunities. You know, I want it, like, if I want my kid to take physics, chemistry, etc. But the other side of the argument is that, and I hear this a lot, kids in small schools are pushed to do so many things and try things that maybe they otherwise wouldn't try.
Like if you're not good enough, you're not going to make the sports team.
Right, exactly. And so one parent told me her kids were really good at academics. They weren't very good at sports, but she liked being at that they were at a small school because that forced them to say, they couldn't just say, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not good at this, so I'm just going to do what I like and what I'm good at. No, you're going to try the things that maybe you're not good at, and you're going to learn a lesson out of it that you can work hard and get better at something.
So in the 1960s, I mean, this kind of entrenched people's feelings on this issue. But, I mean, how do you think our mentality has changed since the 60s?
How has our mentality changed? I think it's a lot of the same argument. It always comes down to, what do we want to pay for our schools? Do we want to pay for other people's schools as well as our own? Are other people's schools worth paying for? How many schools should there be in the state? What's best for the kids? What's best for the state budget? It seems like it's the same questions over and over again.
And the mandated requirements of the 60s kind of come up again and again. The idea that there's got to be a threshold of either number of students in a district or else number of geographic miles a district serves.
That was how they did it in the 60s. Nowadays, usually there's not as much discussion about mandating consolidation directly. It usually maybe is more through other kind of other routes, like, say, talking about pulling back on the special low enrollment weighting that smaller school districts receive because they spend more per pupil because small schools, you know, are less efficient in that sense. So, you know, you can kind of edge toward consolidation by undercutting some of that funding.
Let's talk now with someone else, Missy Carlson. She's a teacher and parent from Orrick, Missouri. And Missy, tell us about Orrick.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me. Orrick, Missouri is a small rural community, about 889 people. We're about 30 miles east of downtown Kansas City. It's a great little community. And it's, you know, I love this topic because you guys are touching on and talking about things that we live, you know, that we live in this rural community with the declining population of students and how we handle that, you know, each year as we see numbers, you know, actually start to decline.
Missy, why is population declining in Orrick, just to the best of your knowledge?
Let's see. The best of my knowledge, I think Orrick is a farming community, well-established farms. So we have a lot of established families. But we also don't offer a whole lot of other, as far as business and industry, in our actual community. There's a plastics factory. I know that employs, I'm not sure how many people that work there, but there really isn't a lot in our community besides our school, as far as, you know, keeping people here. And it's just like Joe and Celia both touched on. It's, you know, it's the heart of our community.
The school is.
And yes, it is. And but the, you know, declining population, I know we experienced a few years ago a tornado and, you know, some families that maybe were not, you know, hadn't lived here long, maybe they left and, you know, didn't come back, or people didn't have insurance and they couldn't rebuild. And, you know, so we saw a little bit of a decline, after that, event happened. But it's our numbers. I've been teaching at Orrick for, this will be my 24th year. And, you know, we used to have two, classes per grade, and now we're down to one. And, you know, we have numbers as small as 9 in a class, in some of the lower elementary classes. So it's, we've definitely experienced, you know, a population decline. That's been something that, you know, we've discussed and talked about over the last, you know, 10 years, especially.
I visited Orrick recently, and the people I met there were just incredibly passionate about the school. And you just said that it really is the heart of the town. Can you explain what you mean by that, that it's the heart of the town?
Well, when an event happens, this was discussed earlier, when an event happens at the school, the parking lot's full. We just recently, this past spring, our art teacher had an art show, and it was just amazing. The library was just full of these beautiful pieces of artwork the kids had done all year. And, you know, everyone was discussing it on Facebook and, you know, giving shout outs to the teacher and the kids. And but the community came out for that. Basketball games. Those are events in our community, you know, football games, music concerts, just everything. It just, people just come together. It brings us all together. And it doesn't matter really what it is, a school play, you know, open house night. We have a great little community that comes together and is just really supportive of our school and the things that we offer.
So Missy, I mean, you mentioned that class sizes have gone down, and that's in spite of most grade levels going from there being two classes per grade to one per grade. And I hear that, you know, especially kindergarten classes are looking especially small. How do you feel about the future of the school?
That's a really good question. I feel with Orrick, it's an established school. It's not something that I worry about at this point in time. But this declining enrollment is something we have to look at. So it does put in the back of our minds, what if, you know, what if it continues? You know, what does happen down the road? You know, our community is, it's a small rural community, and Celia and Joe referred to, you know, if the school were to die, you know, the community would, I think it would just be empty, and it would be, you know, a lonely place, because it does, it brings us all together in so many different ways, you know, 365 days a year. It really does.
As a teacher, do you feel like you have the resources you need?
Oh, yes. We have in our school, our administration, all of the teachers that are there, we're a progressive group. We have we've been a one-to-one school with all of our students having iPads for going on 4 years. If we don't have a resource, we there's not really much that we can't get.
Wait, what do you
I
mean if you don't
have ninth grade science?
How do you get a resource you don't have?
Well, our school is very, very good about taking our requests and listening to what we have to say about how we might use or utilize materials. For example, I teach science, and we, with our building, we have a new science lab, and there was not one time this year that I didn't need something hands-on for student learning that, you know, I wasn't allowed to get. Our school is just, they want us to provide the best educational experience for our students. And I think we're competitive with, you know, even larger schools down the road with, you know, 1,000 or more students. We have, like I said, 300, and we provide a great education because our school is so willing. We even have parents, we have local groups, Lions Club, groups that will make donations, provide materials. A lot of our local businesses, gas stations, they'll make donations
because everyone's invested
in
the school
community. Yes, definitely.
So what about things beyond education, other school amenities? Do you feel as a parent that your kids are getting all of those things, like band or athletics, any kind of extracurricular? Is the school in Oryk able to provide all of that?
Yes. I have four children, and each one of them has been involved in, we have basketball, football, volleyball. We just started a new softball program, clubs. My son, when he was in school, the art teacher took them all over the state looking at museums, artwork. We have many different programs in the elementary, geography clubs, craft activities after school, reading clubs. We do math contests, and we have an academic team. You know, we have a lot of opportunities, and I feel like my children have, it's like you said, with a small school, they can do anything. They have so many opportunities that they might not have at a larger school, to be involved and to, you know, become productive young people, because we have just a great staff that they are invested in those kids. You know, it's not an 8-to-3 job.
How do you sustain all of those different things with the small class sizes?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of the different things and activities that they do, it may not be just for kindergarten. You know, it might be kindergarten through fifth grade, it can all participate, and different teachers will step up and take roles and, you know, adjust the learning or adjust the activity for the students that are there. We have science nights, and it's phenomenal to see teachers, and a lot of teachers will use their own resources. You know, it's an investment, as not only my occupation, but I'm invested in those kids. And if I need to go out and purchase something, you know, to provide for a small group of kids, I can do that. You know, it makes it easier. I don't have to, you know, I don't have a huge group of kids, so I can easily, you know, finance a lot of activities myself. And a lot of the teachers do that.
Celia, we're getting a very rosy picture of a rural school, even one with shrinking class sizes and some admitted concerns about that. But is everything that they're able to do in Oryk at the school where Missy teaches and where her children go, is that typical? Is that what you see in the rural schools you visit?
I think that it varies. I do think that there are a lot of rural schools that are putting a lot of effort into giving kids advanced opportunities. For example, maybe you don't have a community college nearby, but you have your teachers gain the credentials they need to teach a dual enrollment, you know, a college level class, that so that your local high schoolers can get some college credit while they're still in high school. So the schools are trying very hard to offer those opportunities. But at the same time, there are rural schools that are really struggling to fill certain types of jobs. with changing demographics, rural areas need more teachers who are qualified to teach ESL. That is difficult in some areas of the state. Math and science teachers have been difficult to get in some areas of the state. So, I mean, the challenges are very real at the same time.
Well, you can still join this conversation at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. More on challenges facing rural schools in Kansas and Missouri right after this break on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'd like to bring another guest in on our conversation about challenges in rural education. Jenny Russell is with us from Cortland, Kansas, and there's been a sign spotted outside her office in the past, anyway, that reads, Rural by Choice. Jenny, it sounds like you are proud of your rural residence.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we went to college, and our ultimate goal was to move back to Cortland, Kansas. And that's, I wouldn't say rare, but it's not as common as some of the other paths that others take. So, yes, Rural by Choice is what we are. We're educated. We moved here on purpose, and we're very proud of where we're from. We brought our businesses with us and are raising our children in a small rural community.
What's behind your desire to make that particular choice for yourself and your family?
I grew up in a similar size school, and I'm from about an hour away from where we live now. It is my husband's hometown, and it just really has a very positive atmosphere. Almost all the kids, or a lot of the kids that my husband grew up with, all wanted to move back. And I would say that's not always, not always the most common case either. But it is for where we're from. It's a very important place to them, and it's a place where they wanted to move back and live. And I agree that positivism and the progressive attitude there is an amazing place to be.
So you've got kids in school there, and I'm wondering what you see in the schools in Cortland. Are there concerns that you have?
I think there's always concerns just because we want to keep the schools open. And so that's always our goal, and that's always the community's focus. And so we're doing a lot to try to attract rural, young families back with kids and be very welcoming to that. And I think some of our efforts as a county are paying off. We're starting to see we're not in the declining phase as much anymore. We're more in a plateau phase where we're seeing numbers level off. Our kindergarten is actually holding strong. We probably have our kindergarten class this past year was the biggest class in the district. And often that's a good indicator for the strength of your school going forward and the stability of your school going forward. So after, since the 1900s, our population has declined. So I think that's an old news thing now.
Yeah.
Now we're kind of, we're tired of dwelling on that, and we're trying to figure out how to fix it and get it turning the ship, I guess. And some of those efforts, I think, we're seeing pay off.
Well, I want to talk to you about those efforts, but when you talk about the declines of the past, I won't dwell on it, but we've talked about consolidation. Is that something that you've seen in your area?
Yes. Past 15 years, I would say it's been a lot of it. And so I think we're almost to the point now that the money saved is starting to be counterdicted by the land mass that these things are going to have to cover. So again, you're seeing, we're seeing huge amounts of travel time. Some of the schools now in our conference, in our league, they're, a good 2.5-3 hours away, and that's pretty commonplace to have to go travel those distances for sports. So not only are you seeing that for extracurriculars where it's getting harder and harder to play those schools, and if they get much further spread out, it's going to be a challenge. We're also seeing that if we combine as a county. I mean, we're a county, most of our counties are about twice the size of Johnson County and square miles. So you try to put all the kids in one county school, it gets to be a lot of bus time and a lot of gas and a lot more bus routes, So the cost savings that most people think, well, just combine the schools and it'll save all this money. In reality, we run on pretty much bare bones. I was thinking about this question in advance of this, and we have those opportunities, but we figure out the most possible economical way to get there. So, for instance, we have a golf team, but we play sand green golf, which basically means you take over somebody's pasture, they mow it, and they put down piles of gravel or sand for the green. I mean, so it's not like, you know, playing the country club golf course at some large city. It's the opportunity, you get the skills, but it's not the thrill of
and
it
you're
all.
Using what you've got. You've got land.
Exactly. And we talked about state track meets, and there was a kid from Old Pea, Kansas. It's a 1A school. He's going to go run track at Oklahoma State. He was beating the times of 5 and 6 A schools, and the commentators commented, well, Old Pea doesn't even have a track, which is the case for most of our schools. I mean, we have two of the fastest kids in 1A in Kansas. And we don't have a track either. So they run on the streets, they run on the grass, they run on, but
they still run
hills without the frills.
And
that's how we make things work.
I want to jump in and ask Celia Yopis Jepson, we haven't brought up sports much yet on this show, but there are areas where you said that it's sports that have been like deciding factors and major turning points for certain school decisions.
Well, I mean, maybe it's not the deciding factor, but I think that it's a part of the conversation. There are school districts that maybe, as they shrink, will find they have to collaborate with other school districts to get a football team together and such. And that becomes a little bit, part of the conversation about at what point do you need to, talk about consolidation.
Well, I want to turn to Joe Kelly, who's with us from Holton Schools in Kansas, because Joe, Missy's been talking about attracting families to Courtland, Kansas, families who might attend the school. But you've got this other question about attracting teachers, because there are a lot of vacancies in Kansas teaching jobs.
Yeah. And if anybody listening is curious, I would encourage them to Google Kansas teaching jobs. And they'll find that there's over 1,000 positions in the state of Kansas that are unfilled, and it's June 7th. As an administrator, that's a concern, because by now you should have your hiring wrapped up. And so, when you try to attract those new families and you're looking at attracting two people, not just the teacher, but also the other person who, will probably want to be employed or maybe not. But if they want to be employed, then what's there to do for jobs?
So how do these communities create special incentives to draw these teachers or no?
Well, I would guess that it depends on the districts, but if you're going to, there's got to be some incentive.
Well, Missy, I want to turn back to you because you've hinted that there are sort of plans underway in Courtland, Kansas, anyway, that you're really excited about, things that you think are going to turn this around. You're tired of dwelling on the troubles of the past, and you've got big ideas for what to do about the future. What are those?
Well, we've really tried to develop entrepreneurial opportunities in not only adults, but it's starting that in the schools and in the youth so that they come up with ideas while they're still in school of things that could definitely translate to back where we're from. I think just that little hurdle sometimes inspires and makes you look at your place as something more than maybe it is currently and something that definitely could improve. But you always like you just talked about with we have to find somewhere for the spouse to work and things like that. A lot of times that's either creating that opportunity, getting something over the internet. And we talked about what has changed since the 1960s, landmass, as I talked about, and also internet. There's some internet opportunities. You're right. Shortage of, we do have some hiring troubles in the math and sciences in our school system. And that's pretty much universal on all rural schools. It might be universal Kansas too. I'm not sure. But I know, for instance, my mother was a teacher. They had an internet-based Spanish program. They wanted Spanish in the school. They had an internet-based program that was taught in the school. I think it was a teacher teaching over a video conference type of a thing. So those opportunities, I think, have changed how the schools look a tad bit in terms of if you can't find a teacher, maybe there's an internet program out there or a video-based something that somebody's offering or, getting those opportunities come in from elsewhere. And
yeah.
I think that's helpful.
Well, thanks so much. The internet probably is a game changer in terms of – what distance means, but our time is up. Thanks so much to all our guests this morning. Jenny Russell of Cortland, Kansas, Joe Kelly of Holton Schools, and Missy Carlson with us from Orrick, Missouri. It's really been a pleasure. Thanks so much to all of you. And Celia Yopis Jepson of the Kansas News Service, thanks and welcome to KCUR.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this show at kcur.org/centralstandard. And while you're there, check out our past shows on education, most recently one on students with unstable housing in the Hickman Mills District here in town. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Special thanks to Lisa Rodriguez. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman.